Ladies and gentlemen, your attention, please. Damas y caballeros, su atención, por favor. English and Spanish are pretty similar, because when you say atención, you know that means attention, you know? So there's a lot of similarities in the languages. Anyway, I'd like to welcome you all again. Bienvenidos todos y todas. Yo soy Lloyd Rivera, el voluntario coordinador del proyecto. My name is Lloyd Rivera, the voluntary planner of this presentation series. I'm a member of the Old Spanish Trail Association. This program here today and next Saturday is, and the ones that occurred in April and in May, earlier parts of May, every Saturday, is funded through the LEF Foundation of San Rafael, California, by San Francisco. The LEF Foundation provided the grant, a small grant, but large enough to do what we're doing. The Old Spanish Trail Association is going to hold its 16th National Conference at Ignacio, Colorado, the first weekend in June. This series, for these 2 months, every Saturday, has been created through speakers, 10 speakers from Northern New Mexico, specifically the Taos region and Albuquerque, to bring them in so they could share with you historical research that they have researched and experience-based activities, and they have written it down. So they're the speaker group. And the purpose of the series, there are several purposes, but two of them are: one, to provide information to you on Southwest history topics presented by diverse speakers that include Cheyenne, Native American, Hispanic, Indo-Hispano, Jenízaro, Danish, Anglo-American. And so this is perspectives, contributions by diverse presenters. Okay, so this series in April and May here in Taos, as a kind of like to spark your interest for Southwest history and culture and trade. And then as well to provide a background for you so that in the event that you do attend the national conference at Ignacio, Colorado in June, you'll have some information. Then when you attend that over there, your information will be further expanded because the speakers are from Taos Pueblo, from along the Old Spanish Trail route, and some of the presenters as well are from Southern Ute Reservation, where the Sky Ute Resort Hotel is located. Before I present our speaker today, I want to just tell you something that really funny that really happened to me the other day. I went down to Taos Plaza, and I walked into a business where they sell postcards, Southwest jewelry, chewing gum, books, and other types of Southwest merchandise. Anyway, so I was looking at this rack, and I picked up this publication. It's called The Santa Fe Trail Blazers. And I picked it up and looked through it. I said, cool, another Santa Fe Trail history. I said, nice, they have a section here on Esteban, the black slave that came on one of the early expeditions, the Devaca expedition. Then I said, oh, there's information here on Coronado and Juan de Oñate, Cabeza de Vaca. I said, cool, this is really cool, because now they're giving the Spanish exploration of this America, as well as the Anglo-American. And then that reference to Esteban, the black slave that came on one of the expeditions. And then they mentioned the Opata Native American peoples from Arizona. They're mentioned here. And I said, great, cultural diversity is being presented, finally. And this book was printed in 1992. But then I spotted a typo. They spelled the name V-A-C-A, which is Vaca, the last name of Cabeza de Vaca. They spell it with V-A-C-C-A, with two C's. It only takes one C. So then I started really looking at it. And finally, when I finished examining it, I found there were 70 mistakes, including punctuation, usage, spelling, exaggeration, untruths, falsities, and I'm going to just tell you a few of them, okay? One of them, it says here that in 1528, Cabeza de Vaca expedition, that the people that came were soldiers, cavalry. Now, cavalry means Christ, Jesus. When he had to carry the cross to be crucified at Calvary. Well, this guy wrote that the expedition included cavalry, soldiers, and pirates. Pirates? And then there's another section in here that says that in 1821, a group of traders from Missouri were exploring this region, and they were looking for horses that they intended to capture and to trade to the Indians. That by Taos, it says, in 1821, they came to Taos because it was the first Mexican settlement. And that's not true. They were exploring down there by Las Vegas, New Mexico. And they were encountered by a troop of the Ejército Militar Mexicano. That means the Mexican military detail. So they encountered, and the ones from Missouri spoke English, and these other ones spoke Spanish. But there was one guy, Manuel Villanueva, and he was bilingual. So they negotiated. They said they were looking for horses, so they escorted them all the way to Santa Fe. Then there in Santa Fe, they were treated honorably with respect. And then they went back to Missouri. But they left merchandise here, and they took back silver coins and gold. And so then these Missouri traders went back to Missouri, and they came back several weeks later with wagons and mules and horses, and they started a trail. And it was called the Santa Fe Chihuahua Trail. Merchandise from the United States coming to northern Mexico, then from Santa Fe and Taos down to Mexico, Chihuahua. So that started the opening of the Santa Fe Chihuahua Trail. But then later on, they dropped one of the words. It became the Santa Fe Trail. Anyway, it says here that, as well, that William Becknell from Missouri, he was a trader. And he owned 5 slaves. And it says here that there is reference in here to Esteban, who came on one of the expeditions, and that he was black, he was Negro, and it also mentions in here that slavery was permitted in Missouri. And so anyway, oh, let me tell you one more. And it's really interesting because there's about 70 mistakes in here. It says in here that the Indians used to make mole soap from emeralds. I've never heard that. Anyway, so it's an interesting book, and that, like I said, there's about 70 mistakes in here, and these books are available at one of the shops there at the plaza. And what's not so good about this is that people that read these books, they don't stop to consider if it's truth or not, and they believe it. Yes, Warren?
Just as a sidebar, though, I mean, even when people were arriving in America from Europe, they had been reading their books, for example, the Bible or some of the other books by the Greeks that talked about the Amazonian nations. And so those were the images they had in their mind as they arrived. And it just seems like that little book is kind of the same kind of thing. It's a mixture of fact and myth that we accept because it's comfortable. And it's the story we tell ourselves. I think that it would be enjoyable from that point of view to look into why those mistakes are there, like making soap out of emeralds. Sounds a little bit like some of the other myths that someone may have heard in the 16th century about the riches of the Americas. They're so rich, they make soap with emeralds, for example. Seems to fit the pattern.
Yeah. Okay, one thing that I want to add here is that when Kit Carson came, it says in this book that he and some other trappers and traders were going down to Chihuahua and that they were traveling on the Turquoise Trail. Well, the Turquoise Trail is from that side of Albuquerque to Madrid to Cerrillos to Santa Fe. It's a tourism route now. So they were actually traveling on El Camino Real, but there's not any reference that they were traveling on that trail. Anyway, now I present to you our good friend, Rich Sanders.
Thank you, Lloyd, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to you this morning. I'll give you a little bit of background about me. Some of you know me, some of you don't, so I can tell you where I'm coming from. I've been married to the same lady right here for 49 years in July. We have 3 children. And a grandson. Unfortunately, we lost his mom in December because she's one of the victims that you hear about that couldn't get medical insurance, despite the fact that she was a practicing attorney entertainment attorney with a degree from Pepperdine, and so she had an illness that caused her to pass away in December. So now we're parents and grandparents, and then it's my son over there. He's also a practicing entertainment attorney with a degree from, my daughter got hers from Pepperdine. He got his from UCLA, which, by the way, are two of the top law schools in the country. And then we have a third daughter who has a master's in broadcast journalism. So as you can imagine with that background, and my wife has a master's in health administration, so you can, and I have a degree from St. Louis University with a minor in history. So you can imagine we're well read. And so that's what I'm going to talk to you about. But before I get started, I'm going to tell you something else that you should be proud about. Nicholas Kristof, if you don't know him, is a writer for the New York Times. He did an interesting article a couple of months ago about pundits and about you and I.
Excuse me. Can everybody hear? Okay. Thank you, little young man.
He did this article. In this article, he quoted some research that was done by professors at the University of California in Berkeley. Bottom line, what he said was, guess who the real experts are? We are. That he took 82,000 examples of things that was taking place, and he surveyed some of the students and adults he knew, and he followed it to determine who was more accurate, the pundits, the experts, or you and I. Guess who was right most of the time? We were. Now, there's a reason why I'm saying this, because we're afraid to recognize that our common sense isn't as good as the guy that we hear on the radio or television, and we need to stop doing that. So I'm going to try to bring it together to tell you how we do this. And a lot of it has to do with history. I'm a graduate of St. Louis University, and if those of you don't know about it, are Jesuits. And one of the things the Jesuits taught us was that when we left that school, they wouldn't promise us they'd get us a job, but they promised us we'd be educated. And to a fault, they taught us how to think, and they taught me how to think. The first myth that I'm going to talk about in regards to unknown black history and historical myths and realities is this thing that that segregated schools were bad for black people. No, they were not, because I'm a graduate of a segregated elementary school, a segregated high school, went to a university that was probably 98% Anglo. But let me tell you what happened, and this is where, and I'm not saying segregation is good, I'm saying you've got to not listen to the people that are selling you these stories. Here's what I was taught by my mom, rest her soul, my grade school teachers, and my high school teachers. They taught me to have a lot of self-esteem about who I am, because they knew, even though it was segregated schools, that if I felt good about who I was, I would appreciate education, and nobody would tell me I'm not worthy of anything except that which I deny myself. The problem with segregated schools was segregated neighborhoods. So the people that were saying, I don't want my kids bust, I'm a good example of that. They shouldn't have been. What they should have been fighting for was desegregated neighborhoods. And if we had done that, we'd be ahead of the curve. But a lot of the things that I'm going to talk about today ties into this, these myths that we've been taught. I put a bunch of books up here for you to think about and come up and get the name of. And if you just want to get one, get this one here by the professor of history at the University of Vermont by the name of James Lowen. Lies My Teacher Told Me and They've Told You. And that's the problem that we're facing today with the financial crisis, the health crisis, and everything else. So we're going to get a little bit into that. To help get started, I asked Lloyd if I could do a little bit of deviation from the Spanish Trail right here in New Mexico. And he said yes, proceed in doing so. Because again, I'm going to bring this all the way back to why our kids aren't learning in school and what needs to happen in order for us to get there. Now, I hope you can see this transparency. I'll come back to the mic and talk about it.
Let's see. I'm not happy. focus it and then turn it around. Let me have you tell me when you can see it. There you go. Is that it? Okay. Now, this is my Spanish trail. Okay. If you can't see it, I'll explain it to you. It starts over here in Spain. All right. The white part of continents. It starts here in Spain and it comes down to Africa and then it flows over into the area. Over into the area where we are, Santo Domingo, Mexico, Florida, and everything are us up in here. What's familiar about that? That's the same path that the hurricanes take, right? Same path. So that's why the Spanish and a lot of North Africans, Black Moors, other African Moroccans, were ahead of Christopher Columbus. And that's why it made it easy for Christopher Columbus to come into this area of the world. Okay, so keep that in mind as I'm talking to you, because what the Spanish accomplished opened a broader path than the path that we see and we hear about. It's the same path that a hurricane takes. You notice most hurricanes hit anywhere between Mexico and the East Coast, North and South Carolina, right? That's the path that God created, that if you get in it, you're going to come this way. Here's the myth that I want to talk to you about. Christopher Columbus wasn't the first one that came that way, okay? We were lied to. How did it get started in 1963? An Italian congressman convinced some of his buddies in Washington to let's make this big hero out of Christopher Columbus. And there's nothing wrong with that, because Christopher Columbus accomplished quite a bit. But he also did some things that we weren't told. As an example, he hit what is now the islands of Dominica, where you have Dominican Republic and Haiti. And by the way, you see that guy on the end over here? Does anybody know who that is? Alexandre Dumas. Okay? He's the guy who wrote The Count of Monte Cristo and all of that. He's from my father's ancestral land, Haiti. His father was French, mother was black, slave. His father denied him, so he went to France and he became the great writer that we just idolized as kids and as adults. Okay? That's why he's there. And I'm going to talk about the other individual. So I'm not going to take anything away from Christopher Columbus. And by the way, I'm not here to point fingers at any group, any nation, anything. I could care less about that. That's in the past. A lot of the things that went on back then there, it was normal. It was normal to have slaves. That was common. In fact, a lot of African Americans would be shocked if you told them during the Civil War and during the period of slavery, there were black slave owners. And let me ask you this question. Who sold Africans to the Portuguese and the Spanish to get here? Other Africans. So let's put everything out on the table. So I'm not pointing a finger at you if I kind of offend you, because I'm not trying to do that. I'm trying to get the story out so that you can hear and you can understand and help us correct the problems that our political leaders and our financial leaders have led us through and put us in the predicament that we're in. So let me tell you another side of Christopher Columbus. Christopher Columbus was responsible for, along with his son, the extermination of over 300 Native American people on that island. Because he got there in 1492, and by 1560, a whole tribe of Arawaks, I think that's the way they pronounce it, had disappeared. Because when he got the agreement with Queen Isabella, he told him he was going to bring all his money back. He was looking for the city of gold. And I think this gentleman right here in the glasses commented on that. I got a surprise. I know where the city of gold is. It's down by Tusuque. That's where the cities of gold is. And they're still looking for it, okay? So he had to pay her back, and he thought there was gold on that island. So he had his son, as he was going back and forth from Spain, come in and control him and run him and tell him what to do. And those Native Americans say, you're not making slaves out of us. To set an example, He cut off some of their hands, and he would send them back and their legs to make examples, find that gold for me. Didn't happen. Native American wives stopped having children. They would kill their kids because they didn't want them growing up under those conditions. And it was all because he had to pay the queen off. So in less than 100 years, 300,000 people were gone. Now, that may have been common then. Why did that happen? I'm going to tell you why. See up here on the board, I wrote the papal line of demarcation. Some of you have heard it. Pope Alexander IV in 1493 decided he would come up with an agreement that would prevent Spain and Portugal from fighting, and in fact would hurt his revenue coming in to the papacy, his goal. He wanted his cut, so he said, let's come up with this agreement, and you guys won't fight because we're going to split the world up in half. You've heard the story. And what happened was, he said, Spain, you take this part. Portugal, you take the other part. Anything you find in those areas, unless there's a country there or in a monarchy that controls it, is yours. The people, anything. So that perpetuated slavery and all the things that we see today, except France and England said, no, we don't. We're Protestants. We don't care what you do, Pope. We're going to go our own way, and that's why the British came to the other part. So this is a part of history. Now, I'm not being critical of the Pope because maybe that's what you did then. But what I'm saying, here's why I have fault with people. We haven't been told the stories. So we draw wrong conclusions about how we got here, about slavery and things like that, about Christopher Columbus, because there were some other people that were just as famous, and I'm going to tell you about them. I don't know how many of you have heard of the Museum of History in Alexandria, Egypt. They have on record information that tells maps that says in 750 BC, not AD, BC, they can show that there were people coming, black people from Africa coming to this part of the world. They have found also artifacts. And there is some historical data that James Lowen talks about when they asked the native people, hey, where did you get these from? They said some dark-skinned people came over here for years, hundreds of years trading with us. They brought us things and we talked them about how to plant corn and potatoes and things like that. So they took that back to wherever they were from. And if you go to Africa today, those things are common in their diet. What we haven't been taught also is that as a result of the European famine, the things that saved them was the fact that the Native Americans made an agricultural contribution to those people. Well, they said, if you plant these things here, they will endure all the things that's destroying your crops. Now, this draws my interest. This is why I'm reading all of these books, trying to find out what went on and why wasn't I told this? So way back then, 750 B.C., you had people coming to this part of the world. How many of us have read Gavin Menzies' book, 1421, 1434? This says that they have historical data that said the Chinese were sailing all around here in this area of the world. Now, I'm not saying this to criticize or put down anybody who said America's Vespucci and other people came to this. I'm not doing that. I'm saying in recognition, we need to admit this happened and start doing studies to find out what went on because we can learn from it. And that's where I get upset. I spent 5 years at St. Louis University, 1 year because my leg was broken, and they didn't teach me all of that, and the Jesuits were open-minded. They did tell me one thing. They said, Sanders, if we did a good job with you, you're going to find a lot of the things that we know about then. We can't tell you now. You know, the Jesuits are from Spain, and they don't get along with the Pope, you know, because they want to make Catholics like myself and my wife and my son and my daughters think, okay, they don't want that. So that's why the Jesuits are always in trouble with the Pope and the papacy. But I think they did a pretty good job with me, even if I'm not correct. Okay, let me go on. Let me tell you about another individual that you probably haven't heard about. His name is Vicente Guerrero. How many of you ever heard of Vicente Guerrero? Raise your hand. Let me tell you who he is. William, you've heard of Vicente Guerrero? Okay. Vicente Guerrero was the second president of Mexico. Father, African descent. Mother, Native American and other mixtures. Second president of the country of Mexico, yet we don't know anything about him, right? He was born in Mexico, was sent to Catholic schools, was educated, became a general, fought in the independence of Mexico, 1821, and was elected president. Subsequently, the guys that he fought with turned their back on him because the elite did not want a person that they referred to as mulatto being president. They would set a precedent. So the wealthy wanted to keep the common people down, so he was assassinated. But you've heard of Acapulco? That state is called Guerrero, or we would refer to it as Guerrero County. It was named after him. His grandson was a great philosopher, Vicente Guerrero. Now, there's only one book written in English. There's three in Spanish. Every time I go online and try to get it, I can't get it. But eventually, you will be able to get it, because as a result of the civil rights issue in 1960s, more and more of this stuff is coming out. But how exciting is it to know, to read about this guy? Because he resisted his dad's impetus to say, I want you to fight for Spain. He said, no, I'm Mexican. I was born here. I'm going to fight for this country's independence. So what do? They assassinated him. They killed him. So we need to know that. The people of Mexico need to know that. Not because he was black, but because he was the average Barack Obama of Mexico. And the kids there should know, hey, wait a minute. I need to know that, because maybe one day I can be president. So that's the history that I'm talking about. So we didn't know about Vicente Guerrero. Let me tell you another story that Professor Lauren did a study with his students. And he asked a question. And listen to me carefully on this. He said, who are the first settlers of America? And he says, after we have this debate, he had it with all of his classes. I'm going to take a poll to see who you vote for. Who are the first settlers of America? And they went back and forth between Plymouth, Rock, Jamestown. None of them had been told that in 1526 or thereabouts, a little bit before, 500 Spaniards, 100 Africans had made a settlement in South Carolina along the P.D. River. They didn't know about that. Nor did they know that the same period of time, the French had settled what is now known as St. Augustine, Florida. They weren't told that. But they said they voted overwhelmingly. It was either Plymouth Rock or Jamestown, which was about 1625, 26 in that period of time. Okay, and they didn't know about the other things I'm talking about, the other settlements. They all missed it. You know who the first settlers of this part of the world were? Native Americans. It was like this whole group of people were just overlooked. They just forget it. It's simple, isn't it? Hell, they were here thousands of years ago doing things, had places here like Mound City, Illinois, which was, according to what I've been able to read, was quite a place, okay? So I'm saying his story about we weren't told the truth for no other reasons, it's hurt us. How did this get started? You see that over here on the left-hand side where it says cognitive dominance? In 1612, a group of people said, hey, you know what we're going to do? We're going to say, and we're going to start pushing the fact that people of color and women, regardless of the color of the women, if you're Asian, if you're Spanish, if you're Native American, if you're African American, you're second class. The only people that are important are Anglo men. Cognitive dominance. We weren't taught that. We weren't made aware of that. And that's how we've gotten into the predicament that we're in today. Nor have we been taught about the summer of 1787. That's when the Constitution was put together. That's when a couple of guys from South Carolina, one was name was Ruthledge, and they pushed slavery. They aligned themselves with some other states that were small states that were afraid of Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts. And they said, you can't let those states dominate because they're the ones that are going to run you, your states. You're not going to make any money from tariffs and things. So they aligned themselves with these southern states. And the southern states, we want you to extend slavery. First they said they want you to keep it, but then they said extend it to 1808. And they agreed. And that's why they extended slavery. Thomas Jefferson, who was against it, and we know his private life with Sally Hemings after his wife passed away, he was against it, but he wasn't here. He was in France. He was the ambassador to France. He couldn't fight with the other guys. The guys from Virginia were on top of it in Pennsylvania and Massachusetts. They were against it. But these other small states, Delaware, et cetera, they got together. They said, okay, let's compromise. And John Adams wasn't here either. He was in England. He was the ambassador to England, so he couldn't fight. The interesting thing about John Adams, they give him all the credit. You know who the smart person of that family was? Abigail. Abigail, just like my wife, this is the brains of my household. She and William there. But here's the interesting thing. Abigail Adams, John Adams says, isn't this great what they just put together, this great Constitution? And by the way, it is. Let me tell you why it is. And I'll get back to the Adams. This country is so damn unique. You go around the world, you're not going to find another country that was founded on principles. Principles. Unfortunately, we got politicians that are ruling the principles. And that's where it got shortchanged. But Abigail Adams says, how many Native Americans did you have in Philadelphia in 1787? At that, none. How many African slaves did you have? None. How many women did you have in there? None. And you're going to tell me how great this document is? Now, the principles were there, but she made her point, okay? But what happened? They agreed to extend slavery, and so we suffered for it. And then we continued to suffer from it. Through the Civil War, after that, we formed Jim Crow, and that was the Democrats and the Southerners getting together. And how many Democrats could stand up and say, hey, you know, we're responsible for slavery because we got together and we pushed Jim Crow. So we lived through that. See, this is a history we need to teach our kids, and then we will back up. So let me move along in the essence of time. I've given you a little history. I'm going to talk about Estevanico, Esteban the Black, the Portuguese. Here's a picture of Esteban. By the way, this comes
from the New Mexico Office of African American Affairs, right here in this state.
And they have a lot of information that can help you and direct you to what you want. That's Estevanico, okay? Estevanico came here as a part of an exploratory group trying to find the infamous cities of gold. And they wound up, there were 300 of them on a ship. They went to Cuba, they went to Dominican Republic, they went to Cuba, and then they said, just keep going that way. You're going to find it, the cities of gold. And they did, and they went to Florida. And Lord, did they run into a hell's nest in Florida. Mosquitoes, alligators, snakes. And they were right in the path of hurricanes. And eventually, to make a short story short, hurricanes destroyed the ship. That's where all the food and some wives were on. Women were on the ships. And so they said, we're going to transverse Florida, going up through the panhandle from Tampa. That's where they landed. And then until we find the city of gold. So they would go back and forth. Well, eventually the ships disappeared. They don't know today whether the ships were destroyed in a hurricane or what. And so now these guys are stranded with no food. They ate their horses, their dogs, everything. And so they went back out on the Gulf trying to find the ships, couldn't find the ships. Well, they got down to four because they had to go through some of the toughest country of the world, or this part of the world, in southern Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. And I refer to it because of the mosquitoes and the snakes and the alligators. And eventually, they eventually got all the way to what was then Mexico. And as I think Lloyd mentioned the other day, Mexico went further north than what it is today. But for 8 or 9 years, they traversed trying to get all the way to Mexico because the originator of the captain, Padillo Navarrez, Joanne, is that the? Yes. He had made two trips here. One was to Mexico, and he led this trip. He was captain of this trip, but something happened to him. And so they knew, based on hearsay, that you keep going that direction, they would eventually get to Mexico. How did they know this? That black cat on the end was a black Moor, Portuguese. And the Portuguese, he was a black Portuguese Moor from northern Africa, but in Portugal. The Moors at one time dominated that part of the country. Up to 750, starting in 750, up until Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand, you know, put an end to it. And that's when Spain became the big cat on the block. But let me tell you something about the black Moors. The black Moors are responsible for some interesting things. Navigation, they could look at the stars and navigate. That's why they were on these ships coming here. It wasn't so they could mow their lawn, wash their car. It was because they were pretty smart. So they knew how to read the stars and get you where they were going. Estevanico knew where West was, because if it hadn't, he would have wound up in Chicago someplace. But he knew where to go. So they're down to two. Cabeza de Vaca. This book right here, Land So Strange. A Land So Strange. There's a history of it. So he leads them through, for 8 years west, through all of this, some hostile, some not so hostile areas, you know, and they eventually get to Mexico. But it was his knowledge that enabled them to do that. Cabeza de Vaca came from a wealthy Spanish family, and he was there as an emissary to the queen because she said, dude, go with them and protect my money. That's what happened, and he did. He protected her money, and he gets back. And he was the last survivor. Because Estevanico knew how to negotiate with the Native Americans, and that was the reason why they survived. He was pretty smart. So Cabeza de Vaca aligned himself with Estevanico. Occasionally, they were separated, but eventually, they got to Mexico, and there's a mixed story as to what happened to him, because one story says he became the emissary, but there was another explorer that was looking to hire someone that could take him, again, looking for the city of gold. And so they hired Estevanico. Cabeza de Vaca had gone, and he stayed here. And he ran into a tribe of Native Americans, and he tried to negotiate for some women. And that's where the story always got started about black men and white women, which was, you know. But anyway, that's a joke. But he eventually was killed by one of the tribes, they think. They don't know if he died or what have you. Okay, now they say he was the first person of African descent to be in this part of the country. I don't think so. Okay, I don't think so. I think there were others before him. In fact, we know there are others before him. But his accomplishment and Cabeza de Vaca's accomplishment is that they came to this part of the world and they survived. And you think about that. In those days, two strangers, you're going to go from Tampa, Florida, all the way to country of Mexico? That's pretty, you know, food, trying to find food, water, what have you, because a lot of times they had to get back to shore because they didn't have any water out in the Gulf. So that was quite an accomplishment, and he should be looked upon well. So that's Estevanico. The other person I want to talk about is a fellow by the name of Yark. How many have you ever heard of Yark? Yark. Yark doesn't get credit from it. Let me back up just a little bit. In 1803, Thomas Jefferson, who had purchased the Louisiana Purchase from France, now get this now. France and England and maybe Spain, I don't know, they get together in France and they said, we want to sell all that land out there. France didn't even know what it was. The Native Americans said, hey, whoa, our land, why don't you invite us? No, you can't come. This is a true story. They wouldn't allow the Native Americans to go to France to participate in selling land that belonged to them. Get that. So Thomas Jefferson convinced Congress, and they were against it, to buy this land that France didn't even know how big it was for $15 million. And it wasn't actually $15 million because our government owed France $2.5 million from when we were fighting England. So it was really $12.5 million. Okay? So Yark, let's get back to Yark. So that's how the Louisiana Purchase came about. Land purchased by the United States from a country that didn't even know what it was. Hey, you gonna give me $15 million? Yeah. Hey, I just won the lottery. Because they were having trouble with Haiti. Napoleon was getting his butt kicked. They did. But they were having trouble with Haiti, okay? I won't get into that story. Okay, so what happened was Thomas Jefferson had to defend why he bought that land. So he went to this family, the Clark family, from Caroline County, Virginia, who had moved to Kentucky, and he took their son and said, commission them to find out what we've just bought, because I'm catching all of this hell from Congress. I don't know what's there. Well, they happened to have some slaves. The father's name was Yark, and he named his son Yark. And when the Clarks moved from Virginia to Kentucky, they went with them because the Yarks were pretty smart people, and they didn't want to let them go. So the son, William Clark, is commissioned by Thomas Jefferson to explore that area with Lewis. And so they go through St. Louis, and let me just diverse just a little bit, direct myself a little bit. St. Louis, are you familiar with the Ark? Are you understanding how that got started? Okay, in 1939, Congress, as a result of St. Louis was the way you went to Kansas City, which would bring you to the Santa Fe Trail, and it would also take you west further, Denver and on west. And so everything went through St. Louis. Didn't go through Memphis because you didn't have interstate. This is no surprise to you. You didn't have Interstate 80. So you had to go. St. Louis was the way. And by the way, the correct pronunciation is Louis, not Louis. Louis is L-E-W-I-S. L-O-U-I-S is Louis. Have you ever heard anybody say Louisville, Kentucky? My teacher in high school corrected me and said, young man, don't you ever call it that again. It's Louisville. And now what was she doing? She was braining my mind about doing things right. That's what I was talking about, going to a segregated school. You can be just as educated, whether it's a segregated school, a one-room school, or no school, homeschool. Doesn't make any difference. It's the self-esteem that a child is instilled in that child's mind. So it's St. Louis. So St. Louis was where you went. So they go to St. Louis and they head west. And they were doing pretty good up until they got into the Pawnee area. Pawnees were tough. I mean, Pawnees would kick everybody's butt. They would kick anybody's butt. If you want to win Iraq, get yourself about 200,000 Pawnee back then there. They'd beat their butts. We'd be out of that war in a short time. Okay? They were the tough tribe nobody talks about. But anyway, the thing that got them through all of that, up until they got to the Wyomings, the Colorados, that area, wherever the Missouri River went, was Yark, because Yark had this charismatic personality. And they would see him playing with the kids, the Native American kids and all of this, and everybody fell in love with him. And the Native American, well, these people aren't that bad. And the other thing was that York was dark-skinned, and some of them had never seen anybody so dark. And they were told, this is guy, somebody special, but that the big cat in the sky, or the cat S, as I say, because I don't understand this thing about God being male. That just doesn't, because I don't think that, nobody's ever told me about a Mrs. God, so why should he be a male guy, person? You know, I get into argument with religious people, Christians all the time, not religious people. But that served well until one of the tribes told them, look, if you're going to go through the area where you may run into Pawnee, you better get somebody that knows that territory. So they found two Shoshone scouts. One was named Toby, and I think I've got the name, and Sakawagagwa. I may be butchering it up, but these two Shoshone scouts and York was responsible for Lewis and Clark getting to the Pacific Ocean. That's without them, they would have been gone. They would have been buried somewhere. You wouldn't even known about them. How many of you know about that? Nobody tells you about that. Okay. So York was, now York comes back. Lewis and Clark get back to St. Louis. He goes to D.C. and he's just a ticker tape parade, giving all kinds of money, giving land. York didn't get crap. So he goes to Lewis and he goes to Clark and say, wait a minute, you know, I'm married. He was married, had a family. This isn't right, but he never got anything. That's why you don't hear a lot about it, but there are some operas and stories and things that are done about York. So York made a contribution. Now you're saying, how did that affect where we are? It did have an effect. Because just about the time that York and Lewis and Clark were heading that way, a young guy by the name of James Beckwith, okay, right here. James Beckwith was being born in Virginia, and James Beckwith was born anywhere around 1800. James Beckwith's mother was an 18-year-old African slave. His father came from British royalty, Sir Jennings Beckwith. So he decides to get out of, Jennings and his brothers decide to go west to St. Louis because they heard all the opportunity. He buys some land just a little bit west of St. Louis near St. Charles. He gets near the Missouri River because, you know, if you were a farmer then, you had to have water. And he brings his son with him, and he had to go to court three times to make sure that his son was a free person. Because as you know then, and remember I told you back to 1808, Southerners could come north and catch a black person, take him south, and sell him into slavery. So he wanted to protect his son. And so he had two other brothers, Sir Jennings Beckwith, but they were sailors, and they got killed in a pirate raid or something. But anyway, his son grows up. At the age of 17, he's a blacksmith, and then after that, he becomes a trapper. He becomes a fur trapper, because all the fur companies were right there in St. Louis again, and this is a way to make money. So he starts heading west, and he becomes friends of the Native Americans. And eventually he stops selling fur, and he goes west. Say, there's an opportunity for me. And he spends time doing things. Now, you've heard of Kit Carson. Kit Carson was an illiterate. Lord can tell you that. This guy was pretty smart. He had one amazing background as far as West is concerned, going as far south as to Santa Fe, where he owned a hotel down there. And he was a storekeeper in this area, and he traded. He brought goods through the Santa Fe Trail to Santa Fe. Let me tell you about some of the things he did, and I read about him twice. He was a trapper, a trader, a scout, a crow, a war chief, explorer, hotel keeper, dispatch carrier, storekeeper, prospector, Indian agent for the Cheyenne Nation, and possibly co-founder of Pueblo, Colorado. Okay? Now, he did all those things. And he was a friend of the Native Americans. He tried to get Washington, D.C. to understand you're treating these people wrong. See, he wasn't there to kill them. Treat them wrong. But he was ostracized because the guy's mother was black. So he doesn't get the credit that he deserves. Let me tell you, one of the things he did was he found a route in Northern California that got you to the gold country. He found that route. And there were some ladies that said, let's build a monument to the people that enable the people to come to the gold country. And they knew about James Beckwith, but they would not recognize him. If you go there, there's nothing there on James Beckwith. So he was a peacemaker. And as I said, he knew Kit Carson and the Bents. He was in Santa Fe when the Taos Massacre, a so-called Taos Massacre, took place. And he came up here with the army hired him out because they knew this guy knew the country and he knew the people. Here's the fascinating thing about James Beckwith. He lived among the Crow Nation for years. And I think, if I remember correctly, in order to become a chief or respected in the Crow Nation, there are certain things you just have to do naturally, one of which was you got to go out and steal horses and get horses and bring horses, because I think that was one of the ways you could get another guy's wife, you know. I mean, get a wife. The other thing... The other thing was that you had to be able to be seen hand-to-hand combat and fighting another tribe. And the other thing that you had to do was you had to lead a group of guy warriors in battle. But he did all these things. And he went back and forth from California, came back to Santa Fe, went back to Denver, Colorado, served as the peacemaker, went to Washington, D.C., tried to convince the government they were wrong, the way they were treating the Native Americans, helped settle some disputes in the Denver area where a drunk of Anglo young man went out and killed some Native Americans that were just camping in the park, and he had to resolve that. He was an unbelievable guy. What happened to him was this guy here was a friend of his that he met in California, Tom Bonner, who wrote this book. So Tom Bonner got all this information from him, went back to Massachusetts, had the book printed, had an agreement with Beckwith that he would share the revenues with him and lied to him, and when he went back there, didn't even include him. But before he could make any money, guess what? He died, so he didn't get any money either. But this book here, by Eleanor Wilson, who lives today up in Colorado, can give you some more information behind him. Controversial guy, but very important for this area. As I said, Kit Carson and everyone else knew this guy. Much more contributor to this area than Kit Carson was, in a positive way, because he tried to get along with the Native Americans. Another interesting story. So in the essence of time, I got to move on. I'm not doing all of these individuals justice, okay? You know, because I'm going to talk about the Buffalo Soldiers, okay? This is the next group. A lot of people don't know the Buffalo Soldier idea got started from the Civil War. If you want to find out about it, read this book right here, okay? Read that book, because that book will tell you a lot about what happened with they call it United States Colored Troops at the time. There were about 300,000 of them. What happened briefly, Lincoln needed more troops because after the war was extended, young white guys from the North was tired of that. So they said, let me get out of here. So he said, hey, wait a minute. We got to have more troops or we're going to lose this war. So that's how the blacks got involved. That's also what precipitated the Emancipation Proclamation because they knew that now the blacks are free, they would come and join the service. And so they proved their worthiness because you can imagine all the derogatory, lack of confidence things that were said about them. Even the New York Times was critical of them until they were very successful in three battles that they won. And so what happened was they developed this reputation of being good soldier fighters. So when the war goes down, there's no place for the black soldier to go. Can't go back to the South. You can imagine what that would have been like. The northern cities didn't want these guys were fighters now, so if you tried to go into a restaurant to get served and you just fought and died for, hey, wait a minute, I'm not going to, hey, sir, sit down and, you know, eat all you want. So they didn't want them. And so the government recognized an opportunity because they had this manifest destiny thing, you know, moving westward and all of that. God destined us to move west and take the land away from the people it belonged to and all that stuff. But anyway, they needed someone to protect the telegraph lines, the wagon trains, the forts, the settlers, and all of those. And here's an opportunity for a person who could not find a job, did not have a family to go to in a lot of instances. And remember, they would, if they're paid, you paid $25 a day, that's a lot then. A month. That's a lot then, because during the war, the regular infantry guy was, Civil War, was paid about $13, and the black soldiers were paid less. They were paid about $13, I mean. But to get $25 a month or so in those days was good. So that's how the Buffalo Soldier got started, you know, and then they proved their worthiness. Let me tell you an interesting story. General Pershing, Black Jack Pershing, you know where that name came from? Buffalo Soldiers. Kit Custer was given an opportunity to command Buffalo Soldiers, and he turned it down. And they say, had he not turned it down, he probably would have been alive today, you know. Theodore Roosevelt's butt was saved by the Buffalo Soldiers. That's why he commissioned them to be buried, those that wanted to, at the Presidio in California. If you've never been to Presidio, go there. It's a beautiful place, an old fort. It's beautiful. But they were very influential here, and they were very reluctant to kill Native Americans. They'd been there. They didn't want to do it, but they had sworn to protect the settlers. They were involved in trying to prevent Geronimo and the Chiricahuas that he forced to, you know, fight, because a lot of the Chiricahuas were tired of all of this fighting. And he, the Buffalo Soldiers went to that part of the country, to, you know, down the Chiricahua Mountains and everything, and helped get that resolved. And eventually, as you know, they wouldn't let Geronimo be on the reservation anymore, because he would go and recruit guys that didn't want to fight. But they were responsible for that. There was a big rebellion in Lincoln County, New Mexico. The Buffalo Soldiers went down there and settled it. What happened was you had a certain group of farmers and ranchers that were given contracts to sell goods to the troops. That was a big moneymaker then. And you had another group saying, why can't we do that? So they had a range war going on, and the Buffalo Soldiers went down there, and because they had protected a lot of those people coming west, just their presence resolved it, okay? So that's the story about the Buffalo. There's a lot of, I could go into detail about how they got their names. You know, there's three or four stories about that. I won't go into that. Fact is, they made a valuable contribution to the West that was overlooked. Okay. In the brief time I have, there were black families that came out here too. Some from the war, some brought here by slave owners, including there were 11 Mormon families that came from the South and brought their families with them. In Emancipation Proclamation, they stayed out here. Where am I going on this, okay? Here's where I'm going on this. I gave you an example of how I was motivated to go to college and get an education. And it started with my mom, again, rest her soul, and my school teachers. And when they taught me, they taught you the same way. 2 and 2 is 4. See spot, run. Run spot, run, run, run. It had nothing to do with No Child Left Behind or any other program you come up with. It was the fact that my teachers and my mom and my family motivated me to want to learn and said, you have as much right to learn as anyone else. Well, that's what's missing in our school today. So if Lloyd can take this program, put it together, and start at the elementary school level and say, Your parents were from Spain. Do you know your great-great-great-great-grandfather came over from Spain? Or do you know that your African-American relatives came over here and this is what they endured? Or Native American or Chinese American or what have you? Do you know as a Native American your ancestors were responsible for saving Europe? So you make that child feel good about who they are. And regardless of whether they are educated, No Child Left Behind, which is a joke, by a school teacher in a one-room schoolhouse or at home by their mom or dad, They're going to be motivated to want to learn. Let me give you some quick numbers to think about. And I'm a proof of that. My wife's a proof of that. My kids are proof of that. We drill education. I told Took, I said, Took was quantum analysis or something like that. I said to Took this morning, hey, can you think you can teach William to master that by the time he's 8? And Took said, yeah, I can do that. But let me give you a number. Let's suppose hypothetically there are 3 billion people in China and India. Suppose 20% of those 3 billion are school age. You got 600 million kids in those 2 countries beating down the door to get in schools. They can't get in there because the parents don't have the money. Over there, you got to have money to send your kids to school. Over here, we got schools that are empty, that they're tearing down. Okay, so 600 million kids over there. So let's average out and say that we around now 300 million in this country. Using the same 20% number, you get 60 million kids competing against 600 million kids. We're going to lose. Now, take that 60 million and they say we're approaching 50% of the kids that enter high school by the time their class is ready to graduate, they've dropped out. Detroit, it's 85%. Albuquerque, it's 45%. So now we're around the 30 million kids trying to compete against 600 million kids, and they're going to kick our kids' butts. So we need to come up with something to keep these kids in school. And I'm saying the only way that you can do that is you teach a child self-esteem. We could not wear jeans to school. We had to wear slacks. We had to wear shoes with no white socks. Pants had to have a belt. Shirt had to have a collar. Yes, sir, Mr. So-and-so. Yes, ma'am, Ms. So-and-so, our teachers. We had to walk the way the traffic flowed. When I rode the bus to school, if all the seats were taken and one of you got on that bus, I better get my butt up and say, you sit down. And if you refused to sit down, guess what I did? I didn't sit down either. We were taught that. We were taught dignity, self-respect. Last point I'm going to make. David Brooks, noted writer in the New York Times, did an article a couple of weeks ago about a school in Harlem. And you know what they identified, the reason why these kids are excelling and going on to college? It's because they respect themselves. They have self-esteem. So if we can take what this man has put together, put it in a capsule, and sell it at the school level, I'll guarantee you we will reverse that number of kids dropping out of school. Look how our girls and boys dress when they go to school. You've all seen it. And that's nothing but lack of self-respect. And if they don't have self-respect about how they look, they don't care about what they're learning. And that's why we have a problem. So Lloyd is on the right track. I think we need to expose this to our children in a way that they get the message. Thank you.
Questions and answers? Questions first.
Yes.
I just wanted to bring up, I'm reading a book right now called America BC. They found evidence of the Phoenicians and the Celts, and up in Vermont and New Hampshire, they've been able to trace back the languages to the Middle East up to 1000 BC.
Yes. A little of that is in the Museum of Alexandria, Egypt, which was started by the Ptolemies, which was a family, and the Ptolemies, any Ptolemy male heir to the throne was a Ptolemy, a Ptolemenic, and any female was named Cleopatra. There were 4 Cleopatras, a lot of people on that, but you're right. They have that history about around the world, you know, and the fascinating thing is I'm trying to find all these things out. I want to know these things.
I remember, I grew up in the Grants area, and I remember, the last time I saw this was 30 years ago, but there is a stone rock that people consider were Phoenician drawings out west of Los Angeles, off the river Cuerpo, somewhere. It's on private land. I don't think you can get there anymore. But, you know, just to stand there and look across the valley and think that Phoenicians might have sailed up the Rio Grande was a very fascinating thing. And
you know what's interesting to that point? Did you ever notice the similarity between the pyramids of Mexico and the pyramids of Egypt? And I'm saying, well, what's with this? There's connection. Either people from here went there or vice versa. And I think people might... One other quick point.